When your city is surrounded by a large dam, there lies an inherent risk of devastation. Devastation that's not likely to happen, but still exists. On May 31st, 1889, the citizens of Johnstown, Pennsylvania, discovered just how real that risk was as the dam broke, destroying their town and killing thousands. The Johnstown Flood, today, on the Dark Side of Wikipedia.
Sometimes the human mind goes to dark places. Sometimes those dark delusions turn into a reality. A reality so shaded and gray, once all is said and done, the healthy mind is drawn into the documented retelling of these tragic events, trying to find logic, reason, and understanding where there may be none at all. This is the Dark Side of Wikipedia.
The Johnstown Flood, also known as the Great Flood of 1889, occurred on May 31st, 1889, after the catastrophic failure of the South Fork Dam, located on the South Fork of the Little Kamaw River, 14 miles upstream of the town of Johnstown, Pennsylvania. The dam broke after several days of extremely heavy rainfall, releasing 14.55 million cubic meters of water, with a volumetric flow rate that temporarily equaled the average flow rate of the Mississippi River. The flood killed more than 2,200 people and accounted for $17 million in damage at the time. In today's terms, it would be about $484 million in damage. The American Red Cross, led by Clara Barton and with 50 volunteers, undertook a major disaster relief effort. Support for victims came from all over the United States and 18 foreign countries. After the flood, survivors suffered a series of legal defeats in their attempts to recover damages from the dam's owners. Public indignation and that failure prompted the development in American law changing a fault-based regimen to one of strict liability. The village of Johnstown was founded in 1800 by a Swiss immigrant, Joseph Johns, where the Stony Creek and Little Kamaw River join to form the river. It began to prosper with the building of the Pennsylvania Mainline Canal in 1836 and the construction in the 1850s of the Pennsylvania Railroad and the Cambria Iron Works. By 1889, Johnstown's industries had attracted numerous Welsh and German immigrants with a population of 30,000. It was a growing industrial community known for the quality of its steel. The high, steep hills of the narrow valley and the Allegheny Mountains range to the east kept development close to the riverfront areas. The valley had large amounts of runoff from the rain and snowfall. The area surrounding Johnstown is prone to flooding due to its location on the rivers, whose upstream watersheds include an extensive drainage basin of the Allegheny Plateau. According to these factors, slag from the iron furnaces of the steel mills was dumped along the river to create more land for building. Developers' artificial narrowing of the riverbed to maximize early industries left the city even more flood-prone. The river immediately downstream of Johnstown is hemmed in by steep mountainsides for about 10 miles. A roadside plaque along Route 56, which follows the river, proclaims that this stretch of valley is the deepest river gorge in North America, east of the Rocky Mountains. High above the city, the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania built the South Fork Dam between 1838 and 1853 as part of a cross-state canal system, the main line of public works. Johnstown was the eastern terminus of the Western Division Canal, supplied with water by Lake Kamaw, the reservoir behind the dam. As railroads superseded canal bridge transport, the Commonwealth abandoned the canal and sold it to the Pennsylvania Railroad. The dam and lake were part of the purchase, and the railroad sold them to private interests. Henry Clay Frick led a group of speculators, including Benjamin Ruff, from Pittsburgh to purchase the abandoned reservoir, modified and converted into a private resort lake for their wealthy associates. Many were connected through business and social links to Carnegie Steel. Development included lowering the dam to make it top wide enough to hold a road and putting a fish screen in the spillway. The screen also trapped debris. These altercations are thought to have increased the vulnerability of the dam. Moreover, a system of relief pipes and valves, a feature of the original dam previously sold off for scrap, was not replaced. So the club had no way of lowering the water level in the lake in case of an emergency. The members built cottages and a clubhouse to create the South Fork Fishing and Hunting Club, an exclusive and private mountain retreat. Membership grew to include more than 50 wealthy Pittsburgh steel, coal, and railroad industrialists. The lake at the club site was 450 feet in elevation above Johnstown. The lake was about 2 miles long and about 1 mile wide and 60 feet deep near the dam. The dam was 72 feet high and 931 feet long. After 1881, when the club opened, the dam frequently sprang leaks. It was patched mostly with mud and straw. There had been some speculation as to the dam's integrity, and concerns had been raised by the head of the Cambria Ironworks downstream in Johnstown. So today on the Dark Side of Wikipedia, we're discussing the Johnstown Flood, one you may or may not have ever heard of in history class because, yeah, there's a lot of American history that they never taught us in school. This is one you can learn about now and be scared of dams for the rest of your life. Tony and Sean joining you on today's episode. Press subscribe wherever you download podcasts. If you would, leave us a review there on Apple Podcasts. We greatly appreciate that. Any knowledge on your side about the Johnstown Flood?
I'm going to be honest with you. I was right there in that same social studies class that did not teach us this back in seventh grade with you. But how crazy is it when you think of natural disasters current day? We have all this information, this knowledge, tornadoes. Things can happen even with all this tracking and radar and text messages and EAS alerts. Imagine back then when there was nothing and all of a sudden it just happened. And you don't really think of a dam breaking as a huge event that can take such loss of life. But one minute you're having a pipe, you're smoking, you're living your life, you're one of the affluent folks in the steel industry, and then you're dead.
Although I think a lot, I mean, maybe I'm wrong in assuming this, but it seems like the folks in the upstream area were the ones that were just fine. So I think you might have been smoking your pipe, watching the water flow onto the commoners down the row or down the way, like, shit, there goes the dinghy, you know, and it goes kind of just floating down. Well, the dam should the dam's gone. Pour me another scotch, good sir. And, you know, and then, oh, shit, the whole town is gone. And so is your lake. Dams scare me. I don't know that we've had any major dam breaks in our lifetime. There's been some pretty close ones. There's been smaller ones. I remember there was a dam break in the town in Wisconsin called Black River Falls when we were kids. That's where my grandparents were from. And it was the Hatfield Dam there that burst, flooded the town. I don't know if there was much loss of life, but I remember going and visiting the town shortly thereafter. And the Black River in Wisconsin is a sandy bottomed river. And the Lake Hatfield above it, which is the dammed part, all sand, but super deep. So the whole town gets inundated with water. And then it also sand. So it's like the whole town became a beach. It was it was like being on Mars kind of, you know, unlike the skies though, that we're seeing in other parts of the country with wildfires right now, but the sand was everywhere. It was just crazy over the roads, everything. It was like a desert had taken over this town. And they, I remember shoveling it out of, like my great aunt's basement, helping to clean that up. But something like this where thousands of people died, I'm always kind of creeped out by the idea. When I lived in Branson, there's a giant dam there dams up Lake Taneycomo. And there's a series of dams all in that part of Missouri and Arkansas. And during super heavy rainfalls, they have to open those things up. And about 2 years ago, they came pretty close. I think they opened it full way. And they almost had to open up. They had an emergency waterway that never gets open. Because if you open that emergency one, guess what? No more Branson. But it would prevent even more of a cat. It's like, pick your worst of the two. One where it's more controlled and people can get out of the way first. Or one where we're going to, it just breaks. And there's no warning at all, and everyone gets washed away. But they were really close, like within a day or two of more rain, and it would have been shit show Branson if that had happened. But it's just scary. It's scary seeing these massive structures and many of them quite old now. And I can't imagine, you know, the idea that, well, let's fix the little leaks with mud and straw. I mean, I know we're talking, you know, the 1880s, but I would think the ideas on structural engineering were a bit more advanced than hay and straw to fix the leak.
I think that is similar to, you know, earlier on in your life when you can't afford, you're buying your own house. Maybe you rent a place that looks nice, but the owner is somewhat of a slumlord and maybe uses some duct tape to fix that HVAC. And yeah, I think maybe he was overseeing the dam. Oh, we'll put some mud, some straw. Yeah, it'll be all right. Maybe some gum. I know maybe it hasn't been invented yet, but we'll just pop that hole up and that'll be just dandy.
Yeah. What's scary about, another thing to think about that I think a lot of people completely miss, is reporting at the time too was very different. Into the 1900s, we started getting investigative reporting and people calling shit out and saying, this is wrong, you can't be doing this. And then there was a big heyday of investigative reporting, and a lot of people that were trying to just go along status quo lines of things like this, like the super wealthy that made their country club up there on top of the dam and didn't want to spend the money to fix things correctly. At one point in time, and I'm not saying today anymore, I'm saying at one point in time, when every town had a very, you know, extensive newspaper, you had news departments that would report on things, investigate things, and not be afraid of losing an advertiser like the country club or something because you're going to report the stupid shit they're doing because it may be risking the lives of your entire city. At one point in time, things like this became somewhat preventable or called out before shit happened. I feel like we're on a path right now, and I'm not going to get uber political here, but I feel like we're on a path right now where we're in the world of everyone screaming the word fake news to factual events, that we're on the path to this sort of world again, where, yeah, you want the wealthy and the uber wealthy to just, you know, brush over shit because there's power and this shit not get reported or corrected. Guess what? You keep denigrating the media all you want, and you're going to end up in that fucking world pretty quick. And more dams, and it's just because nobody's going to, there's no checking. There's no checks and balances when you go down that road.
I was listening to something earlier yesterday and basically talking about the current president, which, again, not getting into politics, but just over the last 4 years has taken such credibility and changed the societal mindset of everything you hear. We've now almost in the back of our mind without even trying to, is that really true? That seems too outlandish, because the continued bashing of the media. And the point was that should there be a president in an office that actually has the intelligence and has the ability to finish the deal, mm-hmm. is what I heard, because the journalism has been weakened so much that is when we could get in even a scarier of a time than we currently sit.
And the thing is, when we're talking about the news media and stuff, they've already, are there, you know, outlandish reporting things going on? Yes. But the thing is, that's where it's up to the general public to decipher between opinion pieces, editorial pieces, and factual pieces. And I think there's a big gap there in terms of people understanding what is a reporter and what is an editorial. And there's always been editorials, but for some reason, previous generations were very good at understanding the difference between the two. I don't know why that's such a leap today, but even beyond everybody shouting fake news at things, when they're just factual events, we have this world prior to all of that, where these corporations or these news outlets have already been dismantled. They've been dismantled by corporate takeovers and things like that, where news departments have already been cut down to like next to nothing in many small communities. And the small community newspaper, the small community radio station, wherever you had a news outlet, you don't have it anymore. Or it's like one person that's supposed to cover everything from the school board to investigating whether they're putting cow shit and straw into your dam. And then we all go, well, why didn't anybody say anything? Well, because it's all been fucking consolidated down to nothing. And that has nothing to do with everybody yelling fake news. That has to do with just kind of the corporate takeover and allowing of that to happen. And everybody being very complacent, not realizing the effects of letting something like that go, an institution like that, just die and think that, well, I can get that replaced because Bill down the road, he posts every 5 minutes on Facebook, and usually what he says is true. We're relying on that as our news source. Guess what? Bill's not going and investigatively reporting or putting his life on the line or his career or finances on the line to investigate the big corporations that are fucking things up because they can and they have the power to do a cover-up far greater than what Bill and his Facebook page can dig into.
I think what it really comes down to is you and I have a little bit of knowledge behind the curtain, if you will, in the industry, similarly to doctors listening right now, construction managers, whatever industry you're in, if we're not in it, we have the perceived view. So if you are in the medical field, you and I as patients can only understand so much, but with you having actually been a radiologist or a doctor, you know, with us being in the journalism, very vague sense, broadcasting world, no, we've not been investigative reporters or have any experience of that, but we are in the same industry, and we understand that there's a lot of things and a lot of people that happen behind the scenes with the credibility and the ability and the talent and experience to have what comes out in the news world sources and vetted and took the time to report actual factual news. And people that are not in the journalism world, they have the same sense of, is that true or not, listening to a CNN reporter current day or their neighbor that posted on Facebook of what they saw at the corner. And that's the fucked up part of this, is if you don't understand that, to your point, this investigative reporter that spent 18 months doing this background story opposed to Dennis just posting on Facebook, there should be varying levels of how much you take Dennis's post to this 18-month documentary piece.
The and weight.
Not happening right now.
Yeah, there's no understanding of the weight of what it is. And having worked, you know, alongside newsrooms my entire career, I can honestly tell you, I have never worked with one reporter that I ever thought was trying to put their personal bias on a story. Does it happen? Sure. But that's editorial. When we're talking about reporting, when you have reporters that are, you know, and you have people that skim that line, that certainly does exist. But again, I think there was a lot of relying when we got into this world of editorializing everything, that the public would understand the difference between the two. And I think that's where things really kind of fell off, is there's a giant difference. And unfortunately, a lot of people can't decipher between the two. And on purpose, there's a lot of outlets that try to make editorial look like fact. So it's not just 100% people not understanding. It's there's a lot of, let's, you know, pull this curtain over here and make this look like this is a story when it's really someone's opinion piece. Anyway, we'll get off that stool and we'll move on to the second part of the Johnstown flood story. On May 28, 1889, a low-pressure area formed over Nebraska and Kansas. By the time this weather pattern reached western Pennsylvania 2 days later, it had developed into what would be termed the heaviest rainfall event that had ever been recorded in that part of the United States. The U.S. Army Signal Corps estimated that 6 to 10 inches of rain fell in 24 hours over the region. During the night, small creeks became roaring torrents, ripping out trees and debris. Telegraph lines were down and rail lines were washed away. Before daybreak, the Conemaugh River that ran through Johnstown was about to overwhelm its banks. On the morning of May 31st, in a farmhouse on a hill just above the South Fork Dam, Elias Unger, president of the South Fork Fishing and Hunting Club, awoke to the sight of Lake Conemaugh swollen after a night-long heavy rainfall. Unger ran outside in the still pouring rain to assess the situation and saw that the water was nearly cresting the dam. He quickly assembled a group of men to save the face of the dam by trying to unclog the spillway. It was blocked by the broken fish trap and debris caused by the swollen water line. Other men tried digging a ditch at the other end of the dam on the western abutment, which was lower than the dam crest. The idea was to let more water out of the lake to try to prevent overtopping of the crest, but without success. Most remained on top of the dam, some plowing earth to raise it, while others tried to pile mud and rock on the face to save the eroding wall. John Park, an engineer for the South Fork Club, briefly considered cutting through the dam's end where the pressure could be less and create another spillway, but eventually decided against it as that would have quickly ensured the failure of the dam. Twice under orders from Unger, Park rode on horseback to the nearby town of South Fork to telegraph office to send warnings to Johnstown explaining the critical nature of the eroding dam. Unfortunately, Park did not personally take a warning message to the telegraph tower. He sent a man instead. But the warnings were not passed to the authorities in town. As there had been many false alarms in the past, the South Fork Dam not holding against flooding. Unger, Park, and the rest of the men continued working until exhausted to save the face of the dam. They abandoned their efforts around 1:30 p.m., fearing that their efforts were futile and the dam was at risk of imminent collapse. Unger ordered all of his men to fall back to high ground on both sides of the dam where they could do nothing but watch and wait. During the day in Johnstown, the situation worsened as water rose as high as 10 feet in the streets, trapping some people in their houses. Between 2:50 and 2:55 p.m., the South Fork Dam breached. The LIDAR analysis of the Conemaugh Lake Basin reveals that it contained 14.55 million cubic meters of water at the moment the dam collapsed. Modern dam breach computer modeling reveals that it took approximately 65 minutes for most of the lake to empty after the dam began to fail. The first town to be hit by the flood was South Fork. The town was on high ground, and most of the people escaped by running up the nearby hills when they saw the dam spill over. Some 20 to 30 houses were destroyed or washed away, and 4 people were killed. Continuing on its way downstream to Johnstown, 14 miles west, the water picked up debris, such as trees, houses, and animals. At the Conemaugh Viaduct, a 78-foot high railroad bridge, the flood was momentarily stemmed when the debris jammed against the stone's bridge arch. But within 7 minutes, the viaduct collapsed, allowing the flood to resume its course. However, owing to the delay at the stone arch, the floodwaters gained renewed hydraulic head, resulting in a stronger, more abrupt wave of water hitting places downstream than otherwise would have been expected. The small town of Mineral Point, 1 mile below the Conemaugh Viaduct, was the first populated place to be hit with this renewed force. About 30 families lived in the village's single street. After the flood, there were no structures, no topsoil, no subsoil. Only the bedrock was left. The death toll here was approximately 16 people. In 2009, studies show that the flood's flow rate through the narrow valley exceeded 420,000 cubic feet per second, comparable to the flow rate of the Mississippi River in its delta, which varies between 250,000 and 710,000 cubic feet. Wreck of the Pullman cars and engines at the Conemaugh, the East Village, or the East Conemaugh was next. The witness on high ground near the town described the water as almost obscured by debris, resembling a huge hill rolling over and over. From its idle locomotive in the town rail yard, the engineer John Hess heard and felt the rumbling of the approaching flood. Throwing his locomotive into reverse, head raced backwards east toward Conemaugh, the whistle blowing constantly. His warning saved many people who reached high ground. When the flood hit, it picked up the locomotive and floated it aside. Hess himself survived, but at least 50 people died, including about 25 passengers, stranded on trains in the town. Before hitting the main part of Johnstown, the flood surge hit the Cambria Ironworks at the town of Woodvalve, sweeping up railroad cars and barbed wire. Of Woodvalve's 1,100 residents, 314 died in the flood. Boilers exploded when the flood hit the Guitar Wire Works, causing black smoke seen by the Johnstown residents. Miles of its barbed wire became entangled in the debris and the floodwaters. Some 57 minutes after the South Fork Dam collapsed, the flood hit Johnstown. The residents were caught by surprise as the wall of water and debris bore down, traveling at 40 miles per hour and reaching a height of 60 feet in places. Some people, realizing the danger, tried to escape by running towards high ground, but most people were hit by the surging floodwater. Many people were crushed by pieces of debris, and others became caught in barbed wire from the wire factory upstream or drowned. Those who reached attics, roofs, or managed to stay afloat on pieces of floating debris waited hours for help to arrive. At Johnstown, the stone bridge, which was substantially arched structure, carried the Pennsylvania Railroad across the Conemaugh River. The debris carried by the flood formed a temporary dam at the bridge, resulting in the flood surge rolling upstream along the Stony Creek River. Eventually, gravity caused the surge to return to the dam, causing a second wave to hit the city, but from a different direction. Some people who had been washed downstream became trapped in an inferno as the debris piled up against the stone bridge caught fire. At least 80 people died there. The fire at the stone bridge burned for 3 days. After floodwaters receded, the pile of debris at the bridge was seen to cover 30 acres and reach 70 feet in height. It took workers 3 months to remove the massive debris. The delay owing in part to the huge quantity of steel, barbed wire from the ironworks entangled with the wreckage, dynamite was eventually used. Still standing and in use as a railroad bridge, the stone bridge is a landmark associated with survival and recovery from the flood. In 2008, it was restored in a project including new lighting as part of the commemorative activities related to the flood. So, you know, when you think of a dam breaking, you think of a flood coming at you, you think of water rising. I don't know that we're always thinking of literally a wall of debris flying at you. In a lot of ways, it's almost like a tornado, but it's water-based with all the shit in it. So it's not like, oh, I'll swim or I'll get on a piece of debris. It's you're going to get a 2x4 jammed through your, you know, rectum before, you know, you're going to actually, you know, start taking a swim through this shit show. It's just scary as hell to think about. It's a lot like a tsunami almost, you know, just kind of in a more of a narrow path when it's coming at your town through a valley like that.
I'm going to have nightmares about this for the next several weeks. So I am really happy to be a part of the show here today.
Was it the 2x4 reference that made the nightmares happen?
That was it. Everything else I was, you know, not a big deal, not a big deal. Okay, the 2x4. There was a few weeks ago, what was it? The chemical plant or something that had a chemical in it blew up, and there's that video where it looks almost so far out in the distance and then it is on you in a flash.
Yeah,
some foreign country. It's similar to that, where I would imagine being you hear it, mm-hmm. you see it, but then it is on you before, and those people going up the hillside trying to avoid it. My gosh, can you imagine you are literally running to save your life and you think you have escaped it, and then all of a sudden a half a house just comes out of nowhere and takes you out. My God, that is absolutely terrifying.
It is. And, you know, I'm interested to hear about the aftermath of all this and how it, you know, all played out. But when you really, you know, I'm always one trying to find blame, you know, or trying to assess, not necessarily blame, but trying to assess what could have been done to prevent this sort of thing from happening or happening ever again. And I think what we end up looking at here is, okay, well, you had your wealthy barons and everything on top of the lake. Had a few of them had some houses downstream. Do you think that dam would have been so passively maintained as it was?
Can't you just take Mother Nature for her word? Everything has to be dollar bills involved.
It is. Yes, because it's true. Because that's what fucking happened. People.
Now, if he had a new 3-bed, 2-bath bungalow on that side of the interstate, would the tornado have taken that path? Or would it have stayed on the east side of 41?
This is a dam, though. This is something, this is mankind trying to stop nature. And then deciding, well, we don't need to put that much money into it anymore. And the commoners live down there.
So similar to bridge collapses and such, where there were recommendations, safety,
yes.
And
yeah.
Well, it's falling, but it meets the minimum guidelines. Okay, well, if we can save $500,000, then we'll just we'll kick that can down the road.
I'm not saying anyone was trying to kill people. I'm saying dollars and cents is what made it not be secure.
And mud and hay
yeah.
is far less expensive than steel or high-grade lumber, or will have other supports
yeah.
that will keep this safe for much longer.
I think it was kind of the good old boy, like, this will work. I've seen it work before. It'll be fine. It'll be fine.
I know a guy. He's got some extra bales.
It'll work.
He's going to bring it down, we'll be good.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not saying these people were intentionally trying to kill people downstream, but when you're in an area and if you're the one that's in charge of the potential disaster that could happen, you're going to do everything I think you can in most cases to make sure that whatever could cause that disaster to not happen. If you're in the direct path of it, if you're upstream, you may be a little more fiscally concerned about or conservative in terms of what you're going to do to prevent that from happening. Now, at the end of the day, if that shit show happens, yes, you are then accountable. Maybe it's involuntary. I don't know what the correct charge is, but when you kill someone accidentally, is that involuntary manslaughter?
Involuntary manslaughter. Yeah. Yes. I have no personal experience, but I've been told.
Yeah. Something like that, where it's like, I didn't really try to do that, but there was some ignorance involved here. And that's where I think this story is. And that's, again, that's where I go from the beginning, where it's like, and that's why you have checks and balances. That's why you have people that second guess things and check on things and make sure things are being followed. But there probably wasn't a code to follow, quite honestly. At the time, it was probably just, hey, mud and hay, that works. I don't know. I mean, maybe there wasn't a ton of experience at the time either in terms of dams or modern dams and what's sufficient and what's not. So they were just going with what they honestly thought would hold it. I wasn't there, so I can't completely judge, but I'm judging. And I think we need a little bit more of that.
Well, what's very interesting, and we remind ourselves in these tragic events, is there's a reason that there are NTSB, National Travel and Safety Board, guidelines. And because sadly, earlier in times, things have happened where there wasn't minimum guidelines. There wasn't a entire operation that their job exclusively was to investigate accidents. So it's a situation, obviously, this going back to the earlier than the 1900s, that to your point, there may not be a lot of engineering background, and they built it how they thought it would sustain the water.
Yeah, I mean, there could have been just that. And I don't know if that's even called ignorance at the time, if you have no way of knowing the knowledge. But, there could have been that aspect of it as well, certainly in there. But that's why we have those sort of things. And it scares me as some of those things. I mean, do we get to a world of over regulating? Yes, I believe we have. But there is a happy medium where there needs to be regulation on certain things, because when you don't have those, at least enforced, you have shit like this happen. What a scary thing, a term that scares the shit out of me when I hear it these days is, and I'm just throwing this name out there, like NTSB or whatever, recommends, not enforces, not requires, recommends. I can recommend you get the fillet of fish at McDonald's, but I'm also not stopping you from getting a Big Mac either. Now, does that change something in the end course of what you consumed? Yes. I made a recommendation. You didn't follow it. There's no any sort of, negativity. There's nothing that would, you would feel any pain or hurt from or regret from by ordering that Big Mac. It was just a recommendation. You don't like fish. Okay, cool. When it's a recommendation, that's very different than a requirement. And I think we see a lot of those recommendations, that's where we have bridge collapses and things like that. And we've talked about that before, where they recommend you do this. Great. If you have a budget for it, then you don't have to do it either, because it's just a recommendation.
What do you believe is the true reasoning for recommendation? Is it for lawsuit? Is it legality speak? So that when something happens and they don't listen, well, we recommended.
I don't know. I don't know what the answer to that is. And I don't know if it's legality speak or if it's something that's all some of these entities can do, where there's no enforcement. It's not like they don't want to enforce, but there is no enforcement branch of it. And by law, they can't enforce it. Like, their job is simply to make the recommendations and then hope to God that the people on the other end that are receiving that recommendation have some common sense and want to follow the recommendation. Or, I mean, in many cases, You know, you can have these recommendations made to municipalities and such that are in charge of bridges or whatever infrastructure we're talking about. If they don't have a fucking budget for it, they can't build it, you know, and that's where and to raise taxes and stuff, then you have to go to the people and you have to say, okay, the NTSB, for example, recommends we get this bridge fixed because it's highly likely it will collapse in the next 10 years. And if everybody goes, I don't want to pay that extra $4 a month in taxes, or I don't want to pay that extra 2 cents when I buy my Skittles. If everybody says no to that, guess what? No fucking money comes in and that bridge eventually collapses. And then if you trace it all the way down to citizens saying, I don't want to pay more taxes. Nobody wants to pay more taxes, but nobody wants the fucking bridge to collapse either. So it's perspective. It's the ability to think 5 steps ahead. And unfortunately, a lot of the population can barely think 1 ahead. And that's where you get the things happening, because ultimately things do need funding to get done. Nobody can wave a magic wand and say, hey, go build or fix this bridge. Okay, well, how are we paying for it? If that's not done, there's a lot of bureaucratic steps involved, and there's a lot of also then involving the public involved, and it can get shut down at 50 different steps before it's done.
Situations like this bring up a very, and I don't know if this is a show, I don't know if this is a whole different podcast, but the difference between federal and state, yeah, and who pays for what and why.
Well, you have federal, state, and local. I mean, and so, yeah, then you have the arguments between those three entities, and that's where you have the bureaucratic issues of who's going to pay for what. And then eventually, many times, it goes down to a locality level, and the city's like, we budgeted for all these other things. We don't have any budget for this. Well, it's recommended you do that. Not required, but recommended you do that. And if it is required, you can lose a lawsuit and be required to pay, you know, X amount in damages. If you don't have the fucking money to pay it, guess who's not going to get their money? You can't invent the money. And that's where there's a breakdown in the system. And do I know the answer to this? No, I don't know what the solution is. But that's where I'm simply defining the 50 different places where after a recommendation is made, where it can still break down and nothing gets fixed. Where people
walk. It's very easy to want. It's very easy to see and understand. It's very hard to actually do.
Exactly.
It's very hard. So it's a situation where we have become so entitled that, yeah, if we want to speak, we can. And when I say speak, through our fingertips on a keyboard on Facebook. Whereas to actually do, that's very boring. That's very tedious. That takes a lot of commitment, a lot of vigor. Mm-hmm. Nobody wants to fucking do that. So this is a big clusterfuckery of a situation. And usually, more often than not, rather than doing and rather than compromising and preventing such a tragic occurrence, the tragic occurrence happens. And then we're forced to do something because there's been multiple lives lost.
We're forced to do something, or sadly, in many cases, we talk about doing something for 5 to 10 years, and then eventually the shock and the trauma of it fade away enough that we get into a comfortable enough state of going, we can probably get away with how we used to do it.
And then it happens again.
And it happens again. And then it's like, well, we'll do this. We got to plan this. And yeah, and that's the way of the world. And I'm not, it's nothing new. I think this is how humans have worked forever. It's just one of those things where you look at history and you go, I wish we could have improved this by this point in time. And in some ways we have, and in others we fail miserably. It's not a political statement. It's just an observation on human behavior. And it's not one side or this side politically. It's just people. It's selfishness when it comes down to it. People are going to be more interested in what will affect them directly more than what will affect someone else directly. And you have plenty of people who don't operate that way, but I think in mass number, you have it the other way. And that usually is end up where it goes, unfortunately. Let's continue on with the story of the Johnstown flood and find out more of how this all went down at the end of the day. Immediately afterward, the total death toll was calculated originally at 2,209 people, making the disaster the largest loss of civilian life in the United States at the time. This number of deaths was later surpassed in fatalities in the 1900 Galveston hurricane and the September 11, 2001 terrorist attacks. However, as pointed out by David McCullough in 1968, a man reported as presumed dead, not known to have been found, had survived. In 1900, Leroy Temple showed up in Johnstown to reveal he had not died, but had extradited himself from the flood debris at the stone bridge below Johnstown and walked out of the valley. Until 1900, Temple had been living in Beverly, Massachusetts. Therefore, the official death toll should be 2,208. According to records compiled by the Johnstown Area Heritage Associations, bodies were found as far away as Cincinnati as late as 1911. 99 entire families died in the flood, including 396 children, 124 women, and 198 men were widowed. 98 children were orphaned, and one-third of the dead, 777 people, were never identified. Their remains were buried in the plot of the unknown in Grandview Cemetery in Westmont. It was the worst flood to hit the U.S. in the 19th century. 1,600 homes were destroyed, $17 million in property damage levied, approximately $497 million as of today, and 4 square miles of downtown Johnstown were completely destroyed. Debris at the Stone Bridge covered 30 acres, and cleanup operations were continued for years. Cambria Iron and Steel's facilities were heavily damaged and returned to full production within 18 months. Working 7 days and nights, workmen built a wooden trestle bridge to temporarily replace the huge stone railroad viaduct, which had been destroyed by the flood. The Pennsylvania Railroad restored service to Pittsburgh, 55 miles away, by June 2nd. Flood, clothing, medicine, and other provisions began arriving by rail. Morticians traveled by railroad. Johnstown's first call for help requested coffins and undertakers. The demolition expert Dynamite Bill Flynn and his 900-man crew cleared the wreckage at the Stone Bridge. They carted off debris, distributed food, and erected temporary housing. At its peak, the army of relief workers totaled about 7,000. One of the first outsiders to arrive was Clara Barton, nurse, founder, and president of the American Red Cross. Barton arrived on June 5, 1889, to lead the group's first major disaster relief effort. She did not leave for more than 5 months. Donations for the relief effort came from all over the United States and overseas. $3,742,818.78 was collected for the Johnstown relief effort from within the U.S. and 18 foreign countries, including Russia, Turkey, France, Great Britain, Australia, and Germany. Frank Shomo, the last known survivor of the 1889 flood, died March 20, 1997, at the age of 108. Court case and recovery. In the years following the disaster, some people blamed the members of the South Fork Fishing and Hunting Club for their modifications to the dam and failure to maintain it properly. The club had bought and redesigned the dam to turn the area into a vacation retreat in the mountains. They were accused of failing to maintain the dam properly so that it was unable to contain the additional water of the unusually heavy rainfall. The club was successfully defended by the firm of Knox and Reed, whose partners, Philander Knox and James Hay Reed, were both club members. The club was never held legally responsible for the disaster. Knox and Reed successfully argued that the dam's failure was a natural disaster, which was an act of God, and no legal compensation was paid to the survivors of the flood. The perceived injustice aided the acceptance in later cases of strict joint and several liability, so that even a non-negligent defendant could be held liable for damage caused by the unnatural use of land. Nonetheless, individual members of the club, millionaires in their day, contributed to the recovery. Along with about half of the club members, co-founder Henry Clay Frick donated thousands of dollars to the relief effort in Johnstown. After the flood, Andrew Carnegie, then known as an industrialist and philanthropist, built the town a new library. Investigation of the cause of the 1889 dam breach and flood on June 5, 1889, 5 days after the dam breach flood, the American Society of Civil Engineers appointed a committee of 4 prominent engineers to investigate the cause of the disaster. This committee was led by the esteemed James B. Francis, a hydraulic engineer best known for his work related to canals, flood control, turbine design, dam construction, and hydraulic calculations. Francis was a founding member of the ASCE and served as its president from November 1880 to January 1882. The ASCE committee visited the South Fork Dam, reviewed the original engineering design of the dam, and modifications made during repairs. interviewed eyewitnesses, commissioned a topographic survey of the dam remnants, and performed hydraulic calculations in their final report. They concluded the South Fork Dam would have failed even if it had been maintained within the original design specifications, with higher embankment crest and with five large discharge pipes at the dam's base. The claim by the ASCE committee has now been challenged. The ASCE committee completed their investigation report on January 15, 1890, but the report also was sealed and not shared with other ASCE members or the public. At ASCE's annual convention in June 1890, committee member Max Becker was quoted as saying, "We will hardly report this session unless pressed to do so, as we do not want to become involved in any litigation." Although many ASCE members clamored for the report, it was not published in the Society's transactions until 2 years after the disaster in June of 1891. William Shinn, a former managing partner with Andrew Carnegie, became the new president of ASCE. In January 1890, he gave the investigation report to outgoing President Becker to decide when to release it to the public. Becker kept it under wraps until the time of ASCE's convention in Chattanooga, Tennessee in 1891. The long-awaited report was presented at the meeting by James Francis. The other three investigators, William Wardhen, Fetney, and Max Becker, did not attend. The hydraulic analysis published in 2016 confirms what had long been suspected, that the changes made to the dam by the South Fork Fishing and Hunting Club severely reduced the ability of the dam to withstand major storms. Lowering the dam by as much as 0.9 meters, 3 feet, and failing to replace the discharge pipes at the base of the dam cut in half the safe discharge capacity of the dam. This fatal lowering of the dam greatly reduced the capacity of the main spillway and virtually eliminated the action of an emergency spillway on the western abutment. Walter Frank first documented the presence of what emergency spillway in a 1988 ASCE publication. The existence of the emergency spillway is supported by topographic data from 1889, which shows a western abutment to be about 1 foot lower than the crest of the dam remnants, even after the dam had previously been lowered as much as 3 feet by the South Fork Fishing and Hunting Club. Adding the width of the emergency spillway to that of the main spillway yields the total width of spillway wasteway capacity that had been specified in the 1847 design of William Morris, a state engineer. Survivors were unable to recover damages in court because of the club's ample resources. First, the wealthy club owners had designed the club's financial structure to keep their personal assets separated from it. And secondly, it was difficult for any suit to prove that any particular owner had behaved negligently. Though the former reason was probably more central to the failures of survivor suits against the club, the latter received coverage and extensive criticism in national press. As a result of this criticism, in the 1890s, state courts around the country adopted Rylands versus Fletcher, a British common law precedent which had formerly been largely ignored in the United States courts, and then the state's courts' adoption of Rylands, which held that a non-negligent defendant could be held liable for damage caused by the unnatural use of land, foreshadowed by the legal system's 20th century acceptance of strict liability. So there you go. I think my assumptions were correct. At the end of the day, the wealthy paid folks to complete a report. And that report happened to find that none of them and their actions were negligible in the cause of this. Now, I'm not saying that they tried to do this on purpose by any means. They didn't want to do it on purpose. But their actions did end up causing this. And you have enough money and lawyers and attorneys, and you can fight, you know, the commoner down the road that's trying to file a suit 10 ways to Tuesday. You can fight them and they'll never win because they don't have the resources to fight you back. And that's still how a lot of things work today.
We'll just coincidentally design our financial structure to keep our personal assets separated. Yeah. And well, any way for you to actually prove any one of us had behaved negligently.
Oh, we'll do a study. We'll do it internally. And then we're not going to tell you about it for years.
You know, we are absolutely thoroughly going to investigate this. Now, we are going to hire said investigator and we're going to pay them. Therefore, they will represent us how we want them to. But we're on it. We're taking a look at it. Which really sucks when you think of it, when there are so many situations where somebody has absolutely done something wrong. Black and white, there is no issues. Well, they see it this way, they see it this way. No, it is definitive. You fucked up.
Yeah.
But the person that fucked up has more money than the person who they fucked over. Therefore, the victim has to not only deal with what happened to them that led to a point, so much so to a lawsuit, they then have to go through all the legality bullshit only to get jack squat.
But hey, here's a library. Now your grandkids can go borrow Charlotte's Web once at a time. Hope that makes up for all your family losses.
Hey, but we feel really bad, even though that you sued us and we just killed you in lawyer paperwork. But we're going to name this wing of this new hospital that we're help building. We'll name it in honor of your sister, who we accidentally killed.
Actually,
sound good?
You know, we thought about doing that, but we're going to go back. We're going to name it after the person who donated all the money for the wing instead, who also was, you know, partially part of that club and kind of responsible for the negligence. We'd rather name it after them in the end. We'll name this bench outside
but
for your dead sister.
There's a lovely courtyard next to the pond. We'll plant this tree that we won't water.
We'll name
How
one of the koi
after her.
One of the koi will be named after her that are in the pond.
One of these clay pigeons that our CEO out on his ranch, he every other Saturday likes to go shoot. How about we name a pack after her?
And by the way, you can't use that hospital because that's only for people with special coverage that only us wealthy folks have.
Which you don't, because you had to file for bankruptcy twice.
But we'll make sure that those koi get fed.
And we're going to send you some Flavor-Aid in the mail, not Kool-Aid, because you're not worth that much. But we'll get the knockoff for you.
You get Flavor-Aid. Trust me, it'll be really popular later. Just wait. Just wait for Jonestown. Yeah. I know this is Johnstown, but Jonestown's coming up. Oh, the world we live in. As it's interesting when you dig into history, you look at some things today and you go, shit, why is it this bad? And you look back and go, oh, it's always been this bad.
And you know what? As we always like to say when we go through these tragic events and all of these conspiracy theories and selfish people, all of it can be minimized as much as we don't have control.
Mm-hmm.
By not being a dick.
Yeah. That's...
Just be kind. Be kind, even if you don't want to, even if you don't agree with your neighbor's political choices, even though you don't like their red hat with white lettering on it.
Yeah.
And it has Make in America and Again and Great in it. Guess what? Who the fuck cares? Just be courteous to the other person and respect them enough that you realize, guess what? We don't have to agree on everything. You're not feeding my child baby food. I don't give a fuck if you don't like the banana baby food and I like Gerber's and you don't. Just respect each other. And that right there is millions of miles ahead of where we currently are.
As
and I think it can help a lot of things.
It's difficult to do on each side. Completely difficult to do mentally. But you're right. If everyone could have more respect for each other, and it just goes back to the thing, don't be a dick. We could be a lot farther ahead and not repeating history over and over and over. That is going to wrap up today's episode of The Dark Side of Wikipedia. If you like the show, leave us a review on Apple Podcasts and be sure to press subscribe wherever you download podcasts. Until next time, for Sean and all of us at The Dark Side of Wikipedia, I'm Tony Bruschi. Thank you for listening.